So today is March 2nd, 2016. My name is Rob Mason, and I am the Student Project Coordinator for the Allard School of Law History Project. Joining me today is the Honorable Lance Finch. Welcome, Mr. Finch.
Nice to be here.
So let's begin by discussing your childhood. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Edmonton, Alberta, and I lived there until I was 13 years old when my family moved to Victoria.
And where did you go to school?
In Edmonton, it was called Jasper Place Elementary School, and then an intermediate school called Grosvenor. I was just there for 1 year. And then in Victoria, I went to Mount View High School, and then later on, Victoria College, as it then was.
And where did you start working? Did you do anything before law school? Or?
No, I did a variety of summer jobs and part-time jobs. Worked for the provincial government on a survey crew 1 year. I worked on a pipeline job in Alberta 1 year driving a truck. I sold what were called men's furnishings, shirts and underwear at the Hudson Bay Company in Victoria. Mm-hmm. Repaired bicycles. Did a whole bunch of different things.
Anything particularly memorable, or was it?
No, I think all of the jobs I did were good for me. My first job was in Edmonton. I got a job delivering prescriptions for the local drugstore on my bicycle and shoveling the snow off the sidewalk in the winter.
So what made you want to do law?
I was a complete accident. I had sort of wasted my time at Victoria College. I spent 3 years getting 2 years of credit. You can imagine how I filled in the rest of my time. And then I came over to UBC, and I was doing another year of arts. And a friend who had been at Victoria College, a chap named Tony Gargrave, had entered first-year law here. And at that time, I had no idea what I was doing or what I wanted to do. And he said, well, come over to the law school and talk to one of the professors and see what you think. So I did. And then I applied.
Do you remember who that professor was?
Yeah, he was a visiting professor from the East, John Willis, who was a famous name in the day. I think he may have been a friend of the Dean, George Curtis, but he was just here for a year.
And did you consider any other career paths other than law at the time?
Well, I think in high school, I sort of liked the sciences, so I was kind of thinking of maybe medicine or engineering or possibly teaching, but nothing lit my fire.
What were some of your first impressions of the law school?
It was a very friendly place. There were, I think, something like 115 students in our first year class enrolled. We were down to 85 by Christmas time. I didn't know very many of those people before I came to the law school, but it was a wonderful group of people. And the professors were engaging. I don't think I fully appreciated them at the time, but they were good.
So why did so many drop out in that first year?
Well, there were no admission standards. I think the criteria were 2 years of arts and a 65% average. Or if you had 3 years of arts, I think they'd take you with a 60% average. Mm. Basically, you had to be a warm body. There was, of course, no LSAT, so the admission standards were negligible.
Did you find that a difficult transition then from your undergraduate degree to law school?
Well, it was, I think I have to say it was the first thing that really caught my fancy. And I can't tell you why. Balls being hit over fences and hitting somebody sound kind of weird, but it was the sort of thing that caught my imagination.
So what did you do your undergraduate degree in?
Well, I never got a degree, although I spent 4 years in arts. But I was basically doing, in the first year or two at Victoria College, I did physical sciences, which were a catastrophe for me because I didn't do any work. And then I sort of moved over into more social sciences and a bit of languages and stuff.
And when did you graduate from law school?
1962.
What was your law school curriculum like?
They were all sort of what I would call black letter law courses. first year criminal law torts contract, real property, constitutional law, and then on from there. I mean, the second year's, you know, conflicts of laws, agency, wills and trusts, and on and on. They were when I say black letter law courses, they were not theory courses, but I think what some of us felt at the time was that it wasn't really learning how to practice law, it was learning about legal theory, I guess, even though they weren't theoretical courses.
So what kinds of courses interested you most at the time?
I would have to say pretty much everything. I particularly liked torts, I think. But some of it depended on the professors who were teaching. Some were more challenging than others. We had a man named Ivan Feltham who taught us contracts in first year. And he didn't answer any questions for us. He basically asked questions and let us try and figure it out. So I think somewhere along the way, the idea of the common law adversarial system sort of caught my interest.
And did that interest, was that consistent throughout your career? Did that change at all?
No, I articled at a smallish firm that did a civil litigation practice, and I stayed with that firm for 20 years till I was appointed.
And what firm was that?
Gil Yule.
Okay. And what was their main focus?
A lot of insurance defense work. Mm-hmm. We acted for the municipality. There was really only one, what we would call a solicitor in the firm, that did business law. Everybody else did the litigation stuff.
So how did you first get involved with them?
Well, I guess it was early in my third year, I guess. There was no sort of student placement services in those days. Mm-hmm. The student placement services, such as they were was a wonderful person who was the librarian named Diana Priestley. Mm-hmm. And Diana was actually a lawyer, I think, but she was just a wonderful resource. Anyway, I figured out I had to get an articling position somewhere. I didn't know a single lawyer in the province. Didn't know how to go about starting. So I spoke to Diana, and she said, well, there's a guy in Nanaimo who you might talk to. And she gave me his name, and then there's another fellow downtown. And I was sort of vaguely interested in the island thing because my folks lived over there at the time. Mm-hmm. So I went and interviewed him, a man named Hugh Heath, who was a marvelous chap. And I had a very pleasant interview. And he said, well, you can come and work here if you'd like to. But he said, if you're thinking at all of practicing in Vancouver, you'd be better off to article over there. It'd be easier to move over here after you've articled than to try and move back to Vancouver if you article here. So then I went and talked to the other name that Diane had given me, a chap named Frank Collier, who was one of the litigation lawyers in Guild Yule. And, I mean, I don't remember much about the interview. I was sort of hired on the spot, I guess.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was just a different world. It was not nearly so competitive to find an articling position as it is today. Mm-hmm. It's quite a different environment.
So were you pretty confident going into the interview then, in that environment?
Confident?
No.
I don't think I had a clue. I mean, the one thing I do remember vaguely is that I had some interest at that point of going on and doing a graduate degree. And Collier said, well, he said, you know, that's all right. And Collier, bear in mind, was the gold medalist in his class. He said, well, graduate studies is okay, but he said, if you really want to be a litigation lawyer, you should just get in and get your feet dirty and get out of school and get at it. So that wasn't the only reason I didn't pursue graduate studies. I didn't have any money, which is another factor. And whether I could have gotten some or not, I don't know.
Did UBC Law provide any opportunities in that respect, in terms of loans or?
I'm sure there was scholarship money available. I mean, my classmate Frank Iacobucci went on to Cambridge to do graduate studies, and I don't know how that was financed, but I don't think Frank just dug in his pocket and came up with cash. You know what I mean?
So what were some of the differences between practice when you first started out and today?
Well, the bar was much smaller. You'd have to run these, you'd check these numbers with the Law Society, but my memory, such as it is that there were about 1,000 lawyers in the province of British Columbia in 1962-63, and about half of them were in Vancouver. So we're talking 500 lawyers, so it's a very small bar. Not nowadays, there's something like 13,000 in the province, and probably at least half of them are in Vancouver. So vastly different environment. Not nearly as competitive, not nearly as business-oriented. When I started practice, nobody kept track of their time or their billable hours. Mm. You just did the job, and then you got to the end, and you figured out how much you should charge, and the partner would say yes or no, or it's too much or too little or whatever.
Interesting.
Yeah.
How is the workload different than that system?
I don't know. I think I worked hard as a lawyer. Whether I worked as hard as the young lawyers do today, I rather doubt. But it's so different. I mean, we had no computers, no email. Mm. I mean, the great technological advance when I was in practice was an electric typewriter. This was a big deal because the secretaries could really speed up, I guess. But nowadays, the young people all work on their computers, mm-hmm. and I suspect they're more efficient. They're certainly more conscious of how they spend their time than we were. I mean, I didn't start keeping track of hours until I was 4 or 5 years into practice. Mm.
So what was it like serving as Chief Justice of the Court of Appeal?
It was a wonderful job. My predecessor in that office, Alan McEachern, said it was the best job in the world. I wouldn't disagree with him. I still sat in court as much as the other judges in the Court of Appeal. You have some administrative responsibilities, of course, and you have some public functions. Another aspect of the job is that all of the Chief Justices in Canada form what's called the Canadian Judicial Council. It's a statutory body created by the Canadian Judges Act. Mm-hmm. And it has responsibility under the statute for judicial education and the better administration of justice and conduct review. If there's a complaint against a judge, there's a process for reviewing that. So that was wonderful. And you got to meet Chief Justices from all across the country, and that was a very big learning experience for me.
Mm. So I assume you've seen a lot of different approaches to making oral arguments before a court. Mm-hmm. Would you have any advice for students or alumni who might be appearing before a court?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Be prepared. I think it's, not sure if it's Binney or another judge who says, forget the wind-up, just make the pitch. The thing in the Court of Appeal you have to remember is that the written arguments are all filed in advance. The judges read them. They know what the case is about. If it's an unusual area of law or a bit different, some at least of the judges will have brushed up on the authorities that are cited. Typically, one judge would be assigned ahead of time to probably write the first judgment, not necessarily, but probably. So that judge would have perhaps done a little more digging, a little more preparation. Mm-hmm. So when the court sits and counsel start their presentation, the court knows what the case is about. they don't know everything about it, of course, but they've got a pretty good idea, and they will have an idea of what the obstacles are that are faced by the appellant, or what the weaknesses are in the judgment that's being appealed from. So there you, counsel, when I say be prepared, I mean it means not just knowing your material, it's being prepared to anticipate the kind of questions, you know, where are the soft spots in your case, and be prepared to deal with them.
So you've talked about how technology has changed the legal profession in some ways. Are there any other notable changes that you've seen over the course of your career?
Well, as I say, I think it has become, the law profession has become a much more competitive, business-like environment. It's not necessarily bad. I mean, people are charging for their time, so they've got to be efficient. They've got to, you know, be on top of things. One of the downsides, I would say, is that there's less opportunity today for young lawyers to tag along as a junior. Some cases will support a second billable hour on the file, but not all. In my day, I mean, when I was a student, an articling student and a newly called lawyer, it was very common for the young people to go along, literally carry the bag, and sit at the counsel table and take a note and discuss it with the lawyer during the break. The nice thing about that was you got to see not only what the lawyer that you were working with was doing, but you also got to see what a lot of other lawyers were doing and how the court responded to them.
Right.
And how some people were very, you know, adept at addressing a jury and others not so much. Just a lot of different sort of courtroom experience that I think today young lawyers don't get.
So are there any changes in the legal profession that you'd like to see, sort of new directions?
Well, one of the big problems that, it's not the profession, but that society faces is the cost of legal services. And we have spent endless hours talking about access to justice and how to make it more accessible and how to facilitate the needs of people who are complete strangers to the system, who may not have a big case, but to them it's important. And many of these problems of access arise in the family law area. Typically, families don't have a lot of money to throw around at lawyers, but if you're talking about dividing a family asset or an income, or talking about custody or guardianship of children, these are things that are all pretty important to people, and they have a special need for counsel, because typically that kind of case, and you know, the litigants are emotionally involved, so they really need somebody to put a distance between their feelings and what's going on. So anyway, access is a big problem, and I know the law school has a pro bono student program, which I much applaud. I am involved in pro bono stuff to a certain extent. The Law Society is looking at legal aid and what, if anything, can be done to create greater access through legal aid. But it's a problem, and you know, in outlying communities, small communities, there may not be a lawyer for miles around. So, you know, if you've got a domestic dispute, you need some legal advice, where do you go?
What would you say has been the highlight of your career?
Oh, dear. I don't know. I have just had one happy event after another. I loved my 20 years as a lawyer. I liked the people I worked with. I liked the work that I did. I found it satisfying. I found it challenging. I found it educational. When I was appointed a trial judge, I thought that was wonderful. I mean, I was pretty young. I was only 45, I guess. But that was another whole learning curve. all kinds of different areas of law that I had not practiced in at all. Criminal law, family law, a lot of commercial stuff. All things to learn, which was very, very satisfying again. And then similarly, the Court of Appeal, same kind of legal issues, but you're not dealing with problems of evidence or admissibility or credibility, all that sort of thing. You've just got the written record and you've got the lawyer's arguments. But the change there, of course, is that you're working with at least two other judges and sometimes four other judges. And strange to say, they don't always think the same way that you do. So that part of it is pretty interesting. And then being the Chief Justice was, again, another whole new experience. And as I said at the outset, just a lot of different aspects of the job and, again, lots to learn. So what was the highlight? I don't know.
So when you were transitioning into those judicial roles, you said that, you know, you were talking about areas of law that you hadn't really experienced as much. Did you have sufficient guidance and mentorship, do you think, in the early years?
Absolutely. For example, in the criminal law field, first thing I did is I spoke to the then Chief Justice of the trial court, who was Alan McEachern, later became the Chief Justice of the Court of Appeal, but when I started, he was in the trial court. And because I was young, I didn't want to just get limited to doing one kind of work. So he said, well, you can do whatever you want as long as you're prepared to work at it. Mm. And he arranged with what was then the county court for me to sit as a judge alone in county court criminal trials on some kind of a rotation, just to get my feet wet and to sort of remind oneself of certain basic principles like presumption of innocence and proof beyond reasonable doubt and things that civil law lawyers don't have to worry about too much.
Right.
And then the other thing I did, I got some books. I got a book on evidence and spent a summer reading that. I got a book on wills and trusts. Mm-hmm. And in the criminal law area, in other areas as well, but there are a couple of judges in the trial court who were very helpful to me. One was a guy named Harry McKay, and the other is a fellow named Sam Toy, both of whom had long experience in criminal law. And if I had a problem that I didn't know how to deal with, I would consult with them. The trouble with asking judges is, instead of giving you an answer, they always ask you more questions. So I always thought if I went in the coffee room at the break, I could, you know, run my problem by the group and get an answer. Well, you run the problem by the group, but you get six different answers. So anyway, the other judges were very supportive. Yep.
So you've given me a list of some of your classmates from 1962.
Yep.
Do you have any memorable stories or shared experiences with some of these folks?
I mentioned our librarian, Diana Priestley, at the outset, and Diana said, you know, Lance, every class that goes through here has its own distinctive characteristic. And in the case of your class, that characteristic is childishness. And that's pretty much an exact quote. And there were just people who like to have fun and play pranks and do silly things. I mean, you know, somebody would be arguing a moot before student judges in one of the three rooms that we had, the three big rooms. And all of a sudden there would be a fire in the waste paper basket at the back of the room. And then somebody would rush in with the fire extinguisher and making sounds of sirens wailing. And this is tends to be rather disruptive of, of the thought processes if you're the student trying to make your argument. And so was that just kind of foolishness.
Mm.
And but it was fun,
yeah.
And it was there was nothing that was nasty or mean spirited about it. It was just, you know, breaking the tension, sort of.
Sure. Did that bring you together as a class?
I think so.
Yeah,
I think so. I'm not going to point fingers at anybody, but without their being here to have equal opportunity. I chose these names not at random, obviously, but they sort of indicate the breadth of success that classmates had.
Mm-hmm.
Of the 75 who graduated in 1962, 10 became judges. They're not all on this list. Four of them were provincial court judges, two in Alberta and two here.
Mm-hmm.
Bill O'Leary, the gold medalist in our class, just one of the sharpest minds you'll ever meet. Martin Taylor, who was a judge in both our Supreme Court and the Court of Appeal, is about the most articulate person I know in the English language. He was first education in England during the war, and then he got into journalism, and then he came to Canada and he worked as a journalist. I think he was still working for one of the newspapers while he was in law school. But he just has a marvelous command of the language and a hugely curious mind. He's sort of behind all of the things that our class has done with the Paisley Snail, the Donahue and Stevenson case. But he's interested in all things legal, I would say. Marvin Storrow, I think pretty much retired now, but he has been counsel in some of the most fundamental Aboriginal law cases in BC and Canada. He was counsel in the Guerin case and others. Mitchell was a partner in the first tax law boutique in Canada, Thorsonson and Mitchell. And on. They're just now. Mitchell, Doug Mitchell, and Bill Britton. I think probably both QCs. Sorry to say, but Bill Britton was a professional football player. He was playing for the BC Lions when he was in law school.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And Doug Mitchell is also an athlete, and his name is on the hockey arena over here.
Oh yeah, I've seen that.
Okay. And then Yakabuchi, well, what can you say about Yakabuchi? And then Baker is a guy who just decided he was going to go up in the valley and had a very successful practice up there. Anyway, I really need to go through the whole list to get a flavor of it. But if you ask any one of our classmates, they will tell you that 1962 is the best law class ever from UBC.
So before we wrap up, do you have any other general advice for law students?
I guess the first advice would be to try and find or try and make balance in your life. If you like the law and you find a place to practice law, you're inevitably going to end up working very, very hard. And some people allow it to become all-consuming. And I was started down that trail as a young lawyer, and finally my wife said to me, when our kids were little, she said, you know, if you keep on working every night and every weekend, these children will grow up, and they won't know you, and you won't know them.
Mm.
So make a choice. And it was very good advice, all my wife's advice is. So first thing I would say to young lawyers is find some balance. Cut time out for yourself. Nobody is going to make you take a holiday. Nobody's going to make you go skiing on the weekend. If you're going to do something for yourself, you have to make it fit into your life. And you can do it. You know, it's just addressing your mind to it and how you're going to make it work.
Right.
The second thing is to try and find a work environment where you feel comfortable, because I think who you work with makes a lot of difference. And I was very fortunate in the people that I associated with. It's more complicated now. I mean, firms of 100 people or 200 people or the national firms, you obviously can't know everybody, but I still think it's important to try and find a place that's a comfortable place to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the third thing I would say would be to remember that practice of law is a service profession. lawyers have special privileges. Rest of society needs their help. Mm-hmm. So not everybody can pay as much as the service is worth, but it's important to see that everybody gets the service they need.
Any other final thoughts before we wrap up?
I don't think so. I just, you know, life is full of funny twists and turns. I could not possibly have planned my life. If my friend hadn't said, go over and talk to a professor at the law school, who knows?
Yeah.
You know. So take your chances when they come along and enjoy.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to interview with us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.